Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golfing community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Hello, folks, and welcome into this week's Next on the Tee podcast. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro. I hope your week is off to a really, really good start, and you had a wonderful Easter with your families. This week, I've got a great lineup that I can't wait to share with you. Leading off is going to be a guy who is a treasure to our game, and that is former LPGA Commissioner Charlie Meacham. If you're not familiar with Charlie, please go do a Google search on him, and you'll see why I'm such a fan of his. He seems to know everyone. Name a big star from the 60s on up, and I bet Charlie not only knows them, but has great stories about his times with them. He's written 3 wonderful books filled with those kinds of stories. This week, we're going to focus mainly on his most recent book, Arnie and Jack, Stories of My Long Friendship with Two Remarkable Men. And we'll look ahead to the Masters as we always do. It's the perfect time to hear Charlie's stories of spending time with those two legends. Really looking forward to catching up with him. He'll join me here in just a few minutes. Following him, Dr. Bob Winters will make his regular monthly visit with us. This time we'll talk about building confidence and what to do when outside forces are trying to get in our minds and make our minds go down a negative path. This is such an important part of the game, such a big hurdle for a lot of us to get over. Looking forward to hearing Doc's advice when he joins me about 25 minutes from now. In part 2 of this week's show, I'll start off with a return visit from 2003 PGA champion Sean McKeel. I'll talk with Sean about his return to Oak Hill for the PGA Championship last year. It was the 20th anniversary of his PGA Championship victory there. We'll hear about the plaque that's on the site of his famous 7-iron shot to inches of the cup to seal his win back then on the 72nd hole. We'll also talk about how to overcome adversity during our rounds. We all face it. We'll get some advice for Sean how to do it. And what it was like for him playing in the group behind Arnold Palmer during Arnie's final Masters appearance and with Seve during his last Open Championship. So a lot to get into with Sean, a lot of really great stories. Looking forward to having him lead off part 2. And then we'll round things out with a return visit from top 10 instructor Martin Chuck. He has teamed with a great team to promote a set of wedges that I am very excited about. I've got them sitting right here next to me. Can't wait to get them out on the driving range and test them out. Martin will talk us through all the great technology they use to help simplify pitches and chip shots from 60 yards in. You know that awkward distance? Great set of wedges for that. We'll also talk about greenside bunker shots, which you guys know I hate. If he's got me excited about hitting those shots, you know these wedges are something special if he's got me excited about hitting those shots. So looking forward to rounding out this week's show with some more time with Martin. So a lot of great stuff on tap for you this week, folks. And as always, I can't thank you enough for tuning in and taking the journey with me. Before we get started, I want to let you know that our friends over at the PGA Tour Superstore have a grand opening coming up this Saturday, April 6th, in Lady Lake in the Villages in Florida. They will have nearly $30,000 in giveaways for the first guests in line to enter the store. So if you're anywhere near that area, the store is located at 655 North Highway 27-441. Be sure to be on hand and check out that grand opening. It's going to be worth your while to get there early. Also, as I've been saying to you guys all season long, our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry, and I have been working with a company called Kickpoint, and they have done some magical things with our logos and create some polo shirts with some wonderful designs where they take our logos and turn them into designs on a polo shirt. They're absolutely outstanding. Kickpoint Golf is a private label custom golf apparel company making bespoke polo shirts, quarter zips, and hoodies for those selected clubs looking to take their branded game to a whole new level. If you want to check out their apparel, and again, it's going to knock your socks off, send an email to info@kickpointgolf.com. They'll get right back to you. There's no middleman. They're going to go right to the guys that do this work. You're going to check it out, and you are really going to love what they do. I'm going to start showing the polo shirts that they designed for me on my Instagram, at CT Mascaro. Check them out there so you can get a sample of what they look like. These guys know where it's at. Now let's talk about golf getaways and buddies trip locations. When you're thinking about that, think about our friends over at the Macklemore, which is a wonderful resort located just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, high atop Lookout Mountain. It is a casual two-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the U.S. by Golf Digest. The 18th hole is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, The Keep, is under construction and will open summer of 2024. The Keep is a Bill Bergen, Reese Jones design and features a mile and a half of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled up with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024. Both have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You got to see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to macklemore.com to book your stay and play package. Now let's talk about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade. From the very beginning, P790 irons have been rooted in clean aesthetics and thoughtful design. However, their true beauty is found beneath the surface. With AI-optimized weighting and speed foam air on the inside, every iron is uniquely designed to perform exactly how you need it to. As striking as they are on the outside, their true beauty lies within. Learn more about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade by checking out their website at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Now back and next on the tee with me is Charlie Meacham. This is the fourth time that I've been blessed to have Charlie as part of the show. He has not only been a gift to the game of golf, he's a treasure to behold and to be around. Let me remind you a little bit about his background. He's from Nelsonville, Ohio, which is a little southeast of Columbus. He graduated from Miami University of Ohio with his undergraduate degree and then went on to Yale Law School. Charlie served 3 years in the Army. He was the chairman and CEO of the Taft Broadcasting Company, which later became the Great American Broadcasting Company. In October of 1990, he became the commissioner of the LPGA. He's been a business advisor to several golf legends, including Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer, Julie Inkster, Annika Sorenstam, and Donnie Pepper. In 2000, he was named a Great Living Cincinnatian, the highest honor awarded by the city of Cincinnati. He's written three great books. The first is titled Total Anecdotal, A Fun and Unique Guide to Help You Become a Better Speaker and Writer. He followed that up with Who's That with Charlie, which is so fascinating that once you pick it up, you won't be able to put it down. And more recently, Arnie and Jack, Stories of My Long Friendship with Two Remarkable Men. You can get all three out on Amazon.com, and I couldn't be more honored. I get to have Charlie back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Charlie, thanks for coming back on the show.
It is my pleasure, and I appreciate the very flattering introduction. I've had fun in my life more than I deserve, probably, but I'm not going to give it back.
Good for you. Charlie, I'm a huge Jack Nicklaus fan. I know you spent a lot of time with both Mr. Nicklaus and Mr. Palmer, but right. What inspired you to write Arnie and Jack?
Several people said to me over the year or so before I wrote the book, he said, Charlie, you may be the only person alive who knew both of these men intimately at the same time. And I said, well, I haven't ever thought about it, but there certainly weren't many that knew them both as closely as I did. And he said, well, you ought to write a book. And so I did.
And Charlie, in that book, you tell the story about how then PGA Tour Commissioner Tim Fincham reached out to you to try to convince Mr. Nicklaus and Mr. Palmer to collaborate and co-design the course there at the World Golf Village, later becoming the King and the Bear. He said he tried to convince them, but they wouldn't do it. But somehow you were able to. Talk about how you got that done.
This is one of my favorite stories, and it's in the book, by the way. if it, people care to read more about it. But Tim called and he said, I really want to design or build a golf course at the World Golf Hall of Fame of the King and the Bear. But I can't get either one of these guys to agree to do it. And I said, I'm not too surprised. They don't like to share a design, and they design quite differently. So I'm not too surprised. And he said, well, would you give it a try? And I said, well, sure, I will. I'm not promising anything because I know how these guys feel about co-design. So I tried without success, Chris, for several months. And I was always met with the same answer. Oh, I don't have time. And we don't do things together and blah, blah, blah. So I finally had a brainstorm. And I went down to see Jack because I was living, I was working at Arnie's place at Bay Hill. But I drove down to see Jack. And I went through it again. Oh, Charlie, I don't have time. I said, well, okay, I understand. I'll quit bothering you, but just be prepared to play the player Trevino course. He said, what? And I said, we don't think that Tim is just going to quit. If you guys don't do it, he'll approach Lee and Gary, and they'll do it. And I'm not sure you're going to want to play on their golf course. Well, I used the same approach with Arnie, and quick answer is, spades were in the ground within a week. I found their short spot.
There you go. And Charlie, Mr. Nicklaus designed a course for Tap Broadcasting Company. Is that when you first got to know him?
Yes, it is. Although we were both Ohioans, and when my company decided to build a golf course, Jack was the obvious choice, being an Ohioan. So he did it, and it was wonderful, wonderful golf course. But the funny story there, Chris, is that when he had finished, it was a public golf course across from an amusement park that we had built north of Cincinnati. And so when he had finished, I said, Jack, you've done a great job. And he said, yeah, we're going to have a PGA tournament here next year. And I almost had a heart attack. I said, what are you talking about? This is a public course. The trees are just barely whips. The grass is barely growing. I don't care. Dean Beeman owes me one. And we're going to have a golf tournament, PGA tournament here next year. And I said, Jesus, Jack, I'm worried about that. He said, let me tell you something, Charlie. You can make any golf course in the world tournament worthy if you'd make the greens lightning fast, grow the rough, and be sure that the fairways are narrow. And he was right. We did all three of those things. Guess who won the first tournament? Jack Nicklaus. But he was proud of the course, and it's still there.
Was that tied in with Kings Island? Is that the amusement park that you're talking about?
Yeah. When we built Kings Island, we ended up with some extra land across I-71, which we didn't have any use for. It was about 70 acres, and that's when my guys began to persuade me to do a golf course. And that's when I called Jack, and we went from there.
After you retired as commissioner of the LPGA, Mr. Palmer asked you to be his consultant and advisor. What was that conversation like?
Typical of Arnie. The last tournament during my years as commissioner was a team event played at PGA West, not far from where I live here in the desert. So I went down to say hello to Jack and Arnie and wish him well. And Arnie said, I've been meaning to call you. Can we have a beer after my round? So, of course, I said, yes, we can. So after the round, he and I went up to the bar at PGA West, and he ordered each of us a beer, and without any further ado, he said, I want you to join my company and be my advisor and consultant. Well, I hardly knew what to say, but I said, that sounds wonderful. And so after a couple of months of trying to figure out the logistics, he said, there are two things that you got to do. Number one, you got to move to Bay Hill. I was living down in South Florida at the time. You got to move to Bay Hill, and then you've got, you and your wife need to build a place here, or to buy a place here. So we did, and I had 10 incredible years sharing an office with him, not 6 feet apart, and it was a lifetime of absolute joy. We got along great. I consulted with him on everything. I came to, and this will not surprise you, Chris, or your listeners, I learned that nothing important happened in the golf industry unless it was run by Arnie. First of all, if Arnie approved of your idea, you were golden. If he didn't approve of your idea, you might as well forget it. So I had 10 wonderful years sitting about 6 feet away from Arnie and enjoying every second of it.
Charlie, we know what fierce rivals Jack and Arnie were on the golf course, but talk about the side of them where the mutual respect and friendship was.
One of the most often questions I'm asked when people know of my career is, were they really friends? And I said, they were dear friends. And they were very different, but they understood and respected the other guy. They, as I say, they were different. Arnie was a go-for-it guy. Jack was more cautious, but they respected one another. And particularly when, in the early days, it was not easy for Jack. He was, you know, Arnie's fans yelled, "Fat Jack," and he had, you know, he was had a burr haircut. It just was not. It was not like Arnie, but they became close when Arnie and Jack came to realize the mutual respect that they had for one another, and that never changed.
Let's take that a step further, Charlie, because you talk about how different they were when they got older. Mr. Palmer, you talk about how the go-for-it guy, he was still out there playing every day as he aged. Mr. Nicklaus rarely played after he got to a certain age. Neither of them could understand why the other acted the way they did. Arnie couldn't understand why Jack didn't play, and Jack didn't understand why Arnie kept playing.
Well, I began to understand it myself. The reason was fundamentally simple. Arnie played golf for the pure love of the game. Of course, he wanted to play well, but playing well was not what Arnie played golf for. He played because he plain loved the game. Jack played, in my opinion, played golf to win. And he played golf to compete. And once he realized he couldn't compete any longer, then he stopped. But with Arnie, it didn't really matter whether he could compete or not, as long as he could play.
Charlie, in the book, you tell a story about how you were having lunch one day with Mr. Palmer right after the Masters, and you asked him about what he thought about a player in the lead laying up on both 13 and 15. Yeah. Can you share that story?
One of my favorites. We were having lunch. I think we were at La Trobe, and this guy, shall remain nameless, had laid up on both 13 and 15, and he'd been leading the tournament, but he needed to birdie those holes, and he just parred them. So he didn't win. So I said to Arnie, did you ever lay up on 13 and 15? And he looked at me and he said, do you know how many times I finished second at Augusta? And I said, well, no, I don't. He said, neither do I. Never forgotten that. He didn't know what second was.
Yeah. I had Bob Winskowitz, who is the founder of Squares Golf Shoes, on the show a few weeks ago. And Bob actually worked as a director of marketing for Mr. Palmer and his company several years ago.
Yeah.
And Bob talked about how when he would go to Mr. Palmer with a product idea, Mr. Palmer would always ask him, what's in it for the consumer? And to me, that's a microcosm of who Mr. Palmer was, always thinking about his fans, always thinking about the people that would be buying his products. Did you have a similar experience to that when you would pitch products or have products pitched to him?
Always. Arnie cared about the fans more than maybe any golfer that ever lived. He cared about them, and he knew they cared about him. I once was having a drink with him late one night at the Bay Hill Members Bar, and he said, you know, I really can't be alone. He said, I got to be with people. And I remember saying, Arnie, that doesn't surprise me in the least, because people are your oxygen, and you are their oxygen. And he looked at me and he said, you know, you're right. So I think that Arnie lived for his fans, and obviously they lived for him.
You also talked about how Mr. Palmer approached Annika Sorenstam before she played in the Colonial National Invitational on the PGA Tour that year. Mr. Palmer went up to her and asked her a simple question. Why? You had to intervene and explain to Mr. Palmer what her thinking was. Talk about that.
Well, they were playing an exhibition at my club here in the desert, Tradition, and I followed him around. And on 18th tee, Arnie walked over to Annika right in her face and said, why? Well, she didn't know what he was talking about. So once again, he said, why? And I said, I think, Annika, he's asking why you're playing in the Colonial. And so they talked some, but he never really got it. So the next day, I was speaking with Arnie, and I said, I've got an idea to share with you as to why Annika is playing Colonial. He said, okay, what is it? And I said, well, Arnie, if there were a tour above the PGA Tour where the better players were still playing, wouldn't you want to play on that tour? Of course, I would always want to play on the best tour. I said, that's all she's doing. She simply wants to understand how good her game is. So he really got it. And he sent her a wonderful note saying, go for it. Give it your best. I'm behind you all the way.
Wow. I also read that during a dinner you had with Mr. Palmer and his wife, the subject of maturity came up. And when you really reach maturity is when you meet somebody and realize that he or she is better than you are at what you do best. And Mr. Palmer had a pretty interesting response. Do you remember what that was?
I was so embarrassed because after I said that, I said, you know, I've always felt that maturity is when you meet somebody who's better at what they do than you do at what you do. And I thought all of a sudden, oh, my God, why the hell did you say that? And he didn't miss a beat. He said, Charlie, that was Jack. And he said, when I saw Jack, I knew he was the best. And he was. And Arnie never denied that. He could hold his own, but he always felt that Jack was the best.
Charlie, I think what separated Mr. Nicklaus from the rest of the field was his focus and his mental strength. I remember Tom Watson talked about when Jack would walk by and be so focused that people referred to his eyes as the Steely Blues. You had an experience once watching Jack at a tournament where he walked by you and looked you right in the eyes, but he didn't react in any way. You were concerned that maybe you did something wrong. Talk about his level of focus.
Well, the night before that, I had had dinner with Jack and several of his people talking about a deal that we were putting together. So we became pretty close that night. And so the next day, I'm on the course, and I'm standing where I know he's going to come from green to tee, and he walked right by me, didn't even blink, looked me right in the eye. And I was just devastated. My God, what have I done? So I sought out a couple of his guys, and I explained to them what had happened. And I said, have I done something to upset Jack? And they laughed. They said, Charlie, he never even saw you. His concentration on the golf course was such that he didn't even know you were there. And I began to understand that. And that's true, Chris. He had total focus. And Arnie didn't. Arnie played more to the fans, and that cost him a Masters one year. Jack had complete focus. I think Tiger has the same thing, although I'm not sure that even Tiger has the focus that Jack had.
I read that you learned 6 lessons from him, one of them being, don't be afraid to challenge the norm, and the other being, don't ever challenge Jack Nicklaus. Seems like solid advice on both ends. Talk about those things.
My company did a video, which became Golf My Way and was the biggest selling instructional video ever and probably the best. And we had a meeting in New York to talk about how to price it. And in those days, Chris, the pricing of golf videos was in the $30 to $40 range. But Jack said, no, we're going to price this just under $100 because this is the best. And if we price something low, people will think it's not that good. So I said, well, listen, I believe what you say. So we priced it just under $100. And my God, we couldn't sell them fast enough. So I learned then, and I applied this more than once in my career, if you price something below its value, people are going to assume it ain't no good. But if you price it maybe a little higher, then they're going to think, hey, this must be good because the price is good. So I learned a real lesson from Jack on that.
What was it like putting Golf My Way together? That had to be a fantastic project.
Happily, one of Tap Broadcasting's subsidiaries was a company called World Vision. And it was run by a guy named Kevin O'Sullivan, who was a golf nut. And I idolized Nicklaus. So when I called him and I said, would you like to do this video? He just about fell over. And they did a great job of putting together a great, great video, which I think is still the greatest golf instructional video ever and still selling well.
Charlie, going back in your own career, I got to ask you, what was harder for you to do? Pass the bar exam or take over as commissioner of the LPGA?
I was terrified of taking the bar exam. I really couldn't believe, because I'd heard from other people how hard it was. Bar exam lasted 3 days, 8 hours a day, 3 days. And I was scared to death. Well, happily, I passed it. But it was by far the hardest challenge I ever had.
You got to play golf with Paul Brown, and I read in one of your other books that he was a stickler for the rules.
Oh,
no two off the first tee, no rolling the ball in the fairway. Talk about playing golf with him.
I got to know Paul because I had the great privilege of putting together a team that brought the Cincinnati Bengals back to Cincinnati, and we became pretty good pals. And he took me out to play golf the next day, and I teed off first, and I hooked my ball into the house next door on the first fairway, and Paul was very quiet, and I was kind of looking for a mulligan, and Paul said, "You're hitting 3." Oh, okay. So I hit 3 and I went out and my ball ended up in a divot. So I, after being intimidated by his comment on the, after I dropped, hit a drive, I said, Paul, my ball's in a divot. Can I roll it out? And he said, is there water in it? I couldn't believe it. He was unbelievably stickler for the rules, which is one of the reasons, not the only, but one of the reasons why he was a great coach.
Tell the story about the time you took a 12 on the first hole.
Well, this was unheard of because Paul never made mistakes on the golf course. Just one day at Muirfield. Muirfield is a horribly difficult course. And on the first hole, anybody that's played Muirfield will understand this, he hit his ball, his second shot, into a bunker on the right, sand, uphill, fast. He hit the next shot across the green into the other bunker. But by the time this was all done, he had taken a 12. None of us who played that day could even mention it the rest of the day. And finally, after about six holes, we hadn't said a word. And finally, Paul said, "I think that's the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to me." I'm sure it was. But he was a good player. He was a good golfer and an incredible man. He doesn't get the credit that he deserves as a coach because Vince Lombardi gets a lot of credit. He certainly deserves it. But Paul Brown, I think, was the greatest coach that ever lived.
There was also an occasion that you played with him and Neil Armstrong. And I read a story that one particular round that Neil topped the ball off the tee and he hacked at it several times just trying to get it back into the fairway. And when most of us would have picked up after whacking at it several times, but that's not who Neil Armstrong was.
No, he hit into this too was at Muirfield Village. He hit into a bunker on the left of the fairway. And he went in and he hacked at it probably three or four times, advanced it about 5 yards. Finally, we're walking along and Paul goes over and he says, "Is this the man that went to the moon?" we all just about died because he didn't look like the man that went to the moon on that shot.
Charlie, I'm a big space nut. Donnie Hammond and I text back and forth whenever there's a launch. And this year is going to be the 55th anniversary of the Apollo 11 mission. And there have been several stories about them seeing strange things up there and Buzz lobbying to be the first guy out, despite Neil being the commander and all the conspiracy theories that we never went. Did Neil ever talk about any of that stuff?
He never talked about landing on the moon, but it was perfectly clear to me that he was the kind of man that would never, ever talk about it. He just did his job. And I once said to him, "Neil, you got to write a book." "Why would I write a book?" I said, "Well, Christ's sake, you're the first man on the moon." And he said, "Yeah, but there were 1,000 people that got me to the moon. Everybody that helped getting me up and on, I don't deserve the credit." But I never accepted that. I always said, "Neil, you did an unbelievable job." And I'll tell you a funny story. A friend of mine took Neil out on a boat down in Florida. And the captain of the boat was thrilled that Neil Armstrong was going to be on his boat. So they go out in the boat and the captain says, "Mr. Armstrong, I'm so honored and thrilled that you're are on my boat. But let me ask you this. How did you navigate to the moon?" And Neil said, "That wasn't easy. We could always see it right out the window." That's the way he was. He was the most modest man I've ever known. And he just never took credit for what he'd done.
He took you to Cape Canaveral to see the night launch of Apollo 17, our last trip to the moon. But he forgot his wallet and his ID. Talk about how you had to force him to be recognized at the gate.
A friend of mine and I met him for the first night moon landing. And we met in Tampa and drove across the peninsula. And we got about 10 miles from the first guard gate. And Neil says, "Oh, my God, I didn't bring my wallet." I was, "Oh, Jesus, God. What do you mean? I left it back at the hotel." And I remember saying, we're going to go out to that first checkpoint and we're going to say, this is Neil Armstrong. And he's going to say, yeah, and I'm George Washington. So, what are we going to do? So we pull up. It's an absolutely true story. We pull up to the first guard gate. We roll down the window. And the guy says, aren't you Neil Armstrong? And we said, yes, yes, it's Neil Armstrong. So we got in okay. I'll never forget that, ever forget that. But he was such a thoroughly modest human being. And he joined my corporate board shortly after we met. And he was a wonderful board member, smartest man I ever met, with, not surprisingly. You had to be smart to do what he did.
Yeah.
And all the mysteries about who did what, he was always chosen as the guy that would land on them. Never any doubt about that.
Charlie, just a couple more before I let you go. And as an all-time great Cincinnatian, you've also become good friends over the years with Pete Rose. Talk about getting to hang out and play golf with Pete Rose.
I played with Pete a lot. I don't want even to get into whether he should be in the Hall of Fame or not. I'm inclined to think he should, because I think it probably should depend on performance on the field. But Pete was his own worst enemy, but he was a player. And I can remember when my kids were young, we'd go to Big Red Machine ball games. And I'd always say to my kids, point to Pete, play like this guy plays. And I meant it because he was one of a kind. Pete, as I say, was his own worst enemy. But I remember playing golf with him. And he would never come through the ball. And I said, Pete, you've got to come through the ball. You're getting your body through the ball. And I never forget his answer. He said, Charlie, I spent my entire life on my back foot. It's too late for me to change that. It was true. Chris, he was the greatest hitter that ever lived, but it was all on the back foot.
Charlie, with everyone that we've talked about and you've hung out with, you know, Mr. Palmer, Mr. Nicklaus, Neil Armstrong, Paul Brown. I know you hung out with Jim Brown too. But yeah. Then all of a sudden, there's Tommy Thayer of Kiss. It's like, which one of these things doesn't belong? It's like, oh my goodness, what were you doing hanging out with Tommy?
Tommy Thayer is one of the nicest human beings that ever lived, and certainly one of the greatest rock stars. He's a good friend of mine down here where we live, and I just love him to death. He's a real talent, but a genuinely nice human being.
Charlie, there's a line in one of your other previous books that says, if everything seems to be going well, you have obviously overlooked something. What did you mean by that?
Life is tricky. And inevitably, when you sit back one day and say, everything is going great, what a great life this is, I promise you, something will go wrong. Not if the next hour, but certainly the next day. And I think that's simply the Lord making you humble.
Charlie, before I let you go, let our listeners know, how can they go out there and get a copy of any of your books, plus follow you, whether it's online or it's on social media?
Well, I think that Amazon is still carrying all three of my books. I hope they are. If not, you can tell them how to find me and I'll send them a book. But all three books are fun. And the latest one, Arnie and Jack, is quite new, but a lot of fun. And if you can't find it on Amazon, let me know and I'll get them for you.
There you go. Charlie, you are endlessly fascinating and such a treat to get to spend some time with. I can't thank you enough for giving me the privilege again this week to have you back on the show. I hope anytime, we get this privilege again soon.
Anytime you want. Thank you. My pleasure.
Stay safe, Charlie. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charlie. That is the great Charlie Meacham, folks. And I tell you what, they just don't come better than that guy. He's had an amazing career. All three of his books are so much fun to read. The people he's met, the stories he tells are just off the charts good. And I bet, you know, if you couldn't tell, because I surely would have had no idea if I was just listening to this interaction and any of the other times that I've spoken with Charlie. But on September the 12th, Charlie's going to turn 94 years of age. That's how great the guy is. I mean, my goodness, you would have no idea that he was 93 now and about to be 94 before long. He's just an amazing man. Every time I get the privilege of spending time with him, it is something that I absolutely look forward to. Can't wait to get back on to hear more of his stories. And I can't tell you how great those three books are. Go out and get yourself a copy. If you can't, let me know at CT Mascaro on social media, and I'll make sure that Charlie gets one to you. A wonderful man, and I can't wait to catch up with him again soon. Coming up next, we'll get our regular monthly visit from the confidence doctor, Dr. Bob Winters. Before I get to Dr. Bob, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year. And I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player, I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe. And I need all the help I can get. And the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I also want to give a shout-out to my friends over at On Point Golf and their great On Point ball marker. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with On Point, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals, and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023 and they were using an On Point ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use On Point ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. Now let's talk grips. I want to tell you about Lampkin grips. Every shot, as you know, has its own unique feel. The trick? Feel comfortable with each one. And comfort is built into the very DNA of Sonar Plus Black Grips. Composed of their Genesis material that provides supreme comfort and durability, with their fingerprint technology, creates a strong connection and unforgettable touch. The game changes from shot to shot. The feel on your hand shouldn't. Lampkin. Feel is everything. Okay, now back in his regular monthly time slot is Dr. Bob Winters. Dr. Bob has become a wonderful regular part of the show this year. If you don't recall from his previous visits, he is a sports psychologist, author, and professional educator. He has his own performance enhancement company in Orlando, Florida. He is also the resident sports psychologist at the Ledbetter Golf Academy headquarters at the Reunion Resort in Orlando. Doc completed his PhD at the University of Virginia, and he was a member of their athletic coaching staff for 8 years. He earned his undergraduate degree at Ball State, played on the golf team there, and was the team captain for the 1975-76 season. He has coached and counseled several great players out on the PGA, LPGA, and LIV tours, including Brooks Koepka, Tony Finau, Lee Westwood, Justin Rose, and Michelle Wee. And I couldn't be more excited. I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Dr. Bob, how are you, my friend?
Chris, it's great to be back with you. How are you?
I'm fantastic, thank you. So, Doc, I saw that you recently made a trip up to Washington, D.C. Talk about what you did on your visit there.
Well, I'll tell you what, everybody keeps asking me, you know, what did you say? You know, did you meet the president? Did you get everybody in line? And I did not, you know, but I tell you what I did do, you know, my wife, April, and I, we went and saw, you know, two great friends, and they live, you know, right there in the heart and soul, you know, of Washington, D.C., and they could actually walk, you know, every place. Plus, you know, we take the metro and the subway, you know, to the mall and to all the monuments or whatever. And it's just, you know, hadn't been up there in a long time. Obviously, I was there, you know, many years ago when I was doing all my doctoral work at the University of Virginia. With all, you know, my great people, you know, the Dr. Linda Bunker, Dr. Bob Rotella, and, you know, just so many great people that I, you know, studied with and was colleagues with. And, you know, just the whole notion about being, you know, in Washington, D.C., you know, when the cherry blossoms are blooming, you know, we took, you know, a lot of really neat pictures, saw, you know, some great monuments. And I really hadn't taken, you know, that much time to actually go and see a lot of things. I'd been to the Smithsonian Institution before, but, you know, to get up close and personal again with the Washington Monument at night, the Lincoln Memorial, you know, Thomas Jefferson Memorial, all of those. And then, you know, the Martin Luther King Memorial and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You know, those were some great monuments to, you know, unbelievable men. And, you know, the great thing was I took a picture. I don't know if people saw it on Instagram, but it was with a Scottish Terrier. And years ago, I had a Scottish Terrier named BJ. And it was Franklin D., you know, Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. That was his favorite pet. And I guess back in the 30s and 40s, he was quite photographed. And it was, I think they call it Fela, was, you know, the Scottish Terrier's dog name. And everybody asked, they go, wow, you know, Dr. Bob, you must be a real dog person. Well, I'm an animal lover. I mean, I've had so many dogs over the years. I've had, you know, golden retrievers. I've had St. Bernards. I've had German Shepherds. I've had Welsh Corgis. You know, so you name it, you know, I've probably had it, you know. So, you know, my wife and I, April, we love, you know, animals, all animals and all birds. And we live here in Orlando, have a little lake, you know, behind our house. And we're always out there, you know, fascinated by all the different wildlife that's here in Orlando. I mean, and we're not talking about, you know, just the foxes and the alligators and the raccoons and possums and things, but just some great waterfowl. I mean, like the sandhill cranes and the great blue herons and things like that. So, yeah, so we were just, you know, doing the tourist thing, and I hadn't done it for a long time, and that's where we were, Chris.
On your Instagram post, Doc, you also said you're proud to be a Freemason. I don't think I've ever known a Freemason.
Well, I am. I'm a Freemason. You know, I'm a 32nd degree, you know, Master Mason. Yes, you know, and if we take a look, you know, at our founding fathers, many of them, you know, were Freemason and Freemasonry. And obviously it's a secret society, and it's a wonderful society dedicated, you know, to, you know, many wonderful things, you know, patriotism, national order, you know, God, you know, and faith and belief. And really, you know, that, you know, true, what I call true American values. If you think, you know, some of the Freemasons back, you know, in during Revolutionary War times, you know, obviously, you know, General Washington, he had Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, they were all Freemasons. And so, you know, for me to be a Freemason, a lot of people don't really know that. Obviously, I've been part, you know, of, you know, Masonic Blue Lodge and, you know, Scottish Rite. And so you go through, you know, a lot of different things. And I think that's something, you know, that really sort of defines maybe who Dr. Bob Winters is. I'm a man of deep conviction, deep faith. And I had, it was really funny, Chris, because somebody said this to me the other day, one of my young students. And they said, you know, Dr. Bob, you may be one of the most positive, optimistic people I've ever met. And I asked him, I said, what makes you say that? Because everything that you do is just so, there's nothing negative. There's just nothing bad, you know, that really comes out of your mouth. And I know that I've had a lot of people say that to me over the years, but, you know, I get angry. I get upset. You know, I tend to have, you know, not a temper, but I have a deep resolve, you know, when I don't play well. I think I'm a tenacious competitor. And I think it shows through, you know, perhaps in my sports psychology practice is that, You know, when I tell my players, you know, we play to win and we refuse to lose. And what that really means is, you know, winning isn't, you know, about the outer game. It isn't just, you know, shooting the lowest score and picking up the trophy and feeling good about that and taking up the first place check. It's about putting in this winning effort, because that's what the one thing we can control. We can control our thoughts, we control our attitude, and we can control our effort. So to me, you know, you play to win. You put in everything you've got. But the one thing you want to do, you refuse to lose. And when I see great players, you know, like the Scottie Schefflers, you know, like the Tiger Woods, and just a new player, you know, Steven Yeager, who just won at Houston, you know, just a couple of days ago, someone that I've known, you know, for many years. They have this resolve. They want to win, and they play to win, but they refuse to lose. And what that refusal to lose means, they're refusing to put in a lackluster or apathetic effort. And I wouldn't give you, you know, a plug nickel for someone who says, well, if I can't win, I don't really care. You know, I just, you know, if I can't win the thing, I don't care if I finish 21st. Because I remember Gary Player one time saying, the real key to success in this game is, you know, a player who, you know, would rather finish 32nd than 33rd. You know, that's the type of player, you know, that, you know, I'm always trying to help my players become. I saw a slogan years ago. It was a high school class motto that was part of, you know, my family's class. And the class motto was not at the top, but climbing. And I think that's been, you know, something that has been sort of, you know, burned into my memory, is that I'm always trying to get better, always improving. Each day is trying to, you know, become a little bit better version of Dr. Bob Winters than the previous day. And so I'm always striving to see, you know, how good that I can be. And the one thing, you know, that's why I always talk about, you know, are you good? Can you be better? But when you are with someone, giving your time, which is the most valuable asset and resource that all of us have as human beings, is our time, will you give that person your best? So when I was telling this young player, you know, why I'm so happy, I said, I'm so happy because I have lived a great and blessed life to be able to present my thoughts to so many people. And, you know, that people value, you know, what I think. And I'm trying to help them, you know, capture their magic, you know, help them, you know, attain their dream. So this is something that I'm very grateful for. And that's part of it is probably, you know, the way I've been raised, what I believe in, and how I conduct myself, both personally and professionally.
So, Doc, let's take that a step further, because a lot of times, folks with a deep resolve and they put in great effort, they don't remain positive. It gets, if you aren't achieving the things that you want or you're not playing well, a lot of times anger or negative thoughts start to come in. How are you able to have that resolve, put in that effort, but also remain positive?
Well, being the confidence doctor, Chris, and you and I have kind of talked on this, you know, just a couple times before. One of my favorite sayings I've written in many of my books is that patience is confidence waiting to happen. One of the things that, you know, great people, you know, whether they're, you know, golfers, you know, they're professional athletes or business people, or just, you know, wonderful people that you meet, the qualities of persistence and determination and grit, and that, you know, they are just going to go after their dream no matter what, because that's the whole point, is that, you know, who's to say, you know, well, you've spent enough time, you know, going after your dream. And I know there's so many players I have seen have been journeyman players over the years. They just had that resolve. They didn't know when they were going to break through. And that's what I always kept telling them. I said, it isn't, you know, just, you know, that you're going to do it. It's more a question of when, and when will you allow yourself, you know, this freedom, this emotional permission to understand that you are as good as anybody. And instead of going, why aren't I winning, you know, and getting negative about it, you need to keep reinforcing the aspect of, well, why not? Why not me? You know, it's my time. And this is really what I've heard from almost every great champion that I've coached is that they've asked themselves, they looked themselves in the mirror after maybe being at the very bottom of the heap. And they finally, you know, come to the realization, you know, the answer isn't out there in new clubs or maybe in new swing lessons or in new technique. Really, you know, the answer is staring them right in the face. And I've always said, if it is to be, it has to begin and end with me. And that's really what, you know, great players do. They kind of take a look and they go, you know what? I'm going to believe in you, pal. And this is man, woman, boy, girl. It's, you know, whoever it is. They look at themselves and they say, yeah, why not? Why not me? And then if I'm going to bet on something, I don't care if it's 1,000 to 1. You know, the one thing I'm going to do is I'm going to believe in my chances. And I'm going to keep, you know, aspiring to go forward. So that's why I've always said, you know, not at the top, but climbing. And let me tell you something, Chris. You know, a lot of people talk about being positive. It's a tough thing to be positive. It is. It's much easier to be negative because negative thoughts, negative feelings, they stick with us. I mean, they're almost 100 times stronger than positive feelings. And I keep saying this to people is that we are not wired to be positive, happy, optimistic people. We are wired to, you know, survive. You know, we're just trying to get through things. That's why we have this, you know, fear factor. You know, it's, you know, fight, you know, flight or freeze. I mean, that has been something that's been handed down, you know, from Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal man, you know, through evolution. So part of it is if we can actually find a little bit of happiness, a little bit of grace, and a lot of patience, it's funny how good things start to happen. And that's really one of my trademarks. You know, my trademark is change your mind, change your game. And what I mean by that is the moment you change your mind about the things that you're thinking about and you move towards a more purposeful, positive direction, the things that you've been thinking about and your behaviors start to change as well. And that's really, you know, the whole notion about life, because as Earl Nightingale said way back in 1953, you know, when he talked about, you know, this essay on the strangest secret, he said the strangest secret in life is that you become what you think about most of the time. And it just, you know, it just permeates everything in golf, because Harvey Pennick, the great Harvey Pennick, was telling his young students, Tommy Kite, Ben Crenshaw, hey, when you go out there on tour, you need to go out with some positive people for supper, and especially go out with good putters. You don't want to go out with a bunch of people, you know, just hanging their heads down and just go, oh my gosh, you know, I just had a terrible day. Because misery loves company. And I've always said that's why the 19th hole was invented, because we've got a lot of people who want to hang their heads down over a couple of drinks, okay? And that's the whole point. But, you know, when you finally realize, I'm going to quit having a pity party out here on the golf course. I'm going to actually learn to actually look for good things. And I just read something, you know, today. Tiger Woods was giving some great advice to junior golfers. He said one of the things that was most important to him, and I have to agree with it, and I've been talking about it for 40, 45 years, says you've got to pull the positives out of your round. You've got to pull anything at all that's good, and you purge and throw out all of the rest. And if it is something bad and you really can't shake it, then you have to actually say, I'm going to improve that area. So in some of my books, some of the, my, you know, discussions, I always talk about you need to be smarter than your doubt and better than your fears. And what that means is that doubt and negativity is all around you. It will always be around you. And if you have doubt, you've got to be smart enough to realize I'm better than my doubt. I'm going to do this. I'm going to find a way to beat this. And if you have a specific fear, like, you know, just for example, you have a fear of a 50-yard wedge and you feel like you're going to dump it all the time, then you need to go out and practice and prepare yourself and really become very proficient and very competent in hitting those 50-yard wedges so that you don't fear them. And it's funny because I was up the FDR Memorial and there's Eleanor Roosevelt. They had a wonderful statue of her. And the thing about the Roosevelts, they always talked about fear. And the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And Eleanor Roosevelt said, you know, if you have fear, You must face your fear and you must do the thing that you fear. You must work your way through it. And in my world of sports psychology, and I've heard other mental game people talk about, well, you need to fake it until you make it. And I've never agreed with that at all. And I don't like that. That's, you know, to me, that's, you know, perception of deception. I do not like that at all. I would rather say I'm going to do it until I become it. And I think we just take, you know, a note from, you know, Nike and their slogan, just do it. So I'm going to actually do something until I become it. And I will actually work on my competency. I will develop that mastery, and then I will get over that fear. And when you start thinking that way, when you change your mind, you definitely change your game. And that's the power of thought. And it's amazing here in 2024, how many people still think the mental game is all a bunch of huff and puff, smoke and mirrors. But I can tell you, you know, firsthand, it is something very real, you know, and you will hear every PGA, LPGA, Live Tour winner talk about how they got their mind, their mood set, and their attitude in the right place. And lo and behold, they end up holding the trophy at the end of the week.
Doc, I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago. You talked about how we're not wired to be positive, optimistic people. Why aren't we? I would think negativity and being down on ourselves and that sort of thing is sort of a learned behavior. Why aren't we wired to be more positive?
Well, I think, you know, when you think about childhood development, and we can even go back to, you know, the great researcher Piaget, he was talking about, you know, a baby and a young infant, they hear no something like 400 times a day. No, don't touch that. No, put that down. And I think, you know, even it goes back into grade school, and middle school, and high school. If you know the answer, you think you know the answer, and you raise your hand up, and they say, well, who was the third president of the United States in U.S. history? And you sit there and you go, it's John Quincy Adams. Well, the answer is Thomas Jefferson. And everybody looks at you and they go, you're such an incredible loser. And they start making fun of you. And you just don't want to raise your hand again. So what happens, I think we learn to be fearful through our very critical educational system. And even, you know, when we take spelling tests, you know, I remember if you took a spelling test, you'd have maybe 10, you know, spelling words. And at the top, you wouldn't get 8 correct. It would be -2 if you had, you know, 10 questions, right? It would always be that -2. You see, so I think that's what happens. We have been reinforced through this whole notion of negativity. And it's much easier, you know, it's much easier to be negative because in golf, I've always had this equation is that, you know, when your results do not equal or match your expectation, what, you know, you become frustrated, angry, disappointed, and discouraged. And that's why so many people have sort of this expectation gap. We expect certain things to happen before we go play. You know, this is the way things should be. This is the way things could be, or I want them to be. But our reality is a far cry from that expectation. So, you know, we have sort of this dream that we're going to go out and really have a great Saturday. And then we go out and we just go ahead and just, well, we shoot, you know, a high number, and it's a dismal round. So we become frustrated, we become angry, and we go, my God, that was so far off from what I really wanted to do. So I think these are, you know, a few of the things, you know, that we have to deal with. I mean, just, you know, through, you know, our brain, our neurological wiring, is that, you know, we're more susceptible to, you know, pay attention to things that are keeping us alive and keeping us, you know, in a survival mode versus just, you know, keeping us happy. It's not that we know we don't want to be happy. I'm just saying it's much easier to be negative than it is to be positive.
Doc, you're doing some great work with some kids and the junior players around, not just here in the States, but also up in Canada. You did a Zoom call with some junior players there at Sawmill Golf Course in Ontario. What message did you want to instill in those young players?
Yeah, I wanted to talk to them, you know, about this whole notion. And it was that, you know, Sawmill Performance Team, I was working with Kelly McCandless with her Summit Junior Tour out in Colorado these past many weeks. And with all of these different groups, even with our Ledbetter Junior Golf Academy here at Reunion, you know, the one thing I want to talk about is I want to talk about three things. I want to talk about you have to have a personal playing philosophy. This is your game. You work on it. You train it. You prepare for it. And you need to take ownership of it. So when you go out, I want you to enjoy your time. I want you to enjoy being creative on the golf course. I want you to learn how to play your game the way you see it. That's the first thing. The second thing is your opponent isn't anyone else. It isn't anyone else in the field. The opponent is the game itself. It's the golf course. And if you can go out and beat the golf course and embrace the conditions, embrace, you know, whatever the superintendent, you know, has set up the golf course that day, and you can say, all right, you know, it's me, my ball, and my target, and we're going to have a blast finding out how good I will allow myself to be today. And then the third thing I'm always preaching, you know, to everyone, I don't care if they're a grizzled veteran or a newcomer to the game, is knowing what it means to play one shot at a time. Because when you are playing one shot at a time, Chris, you are in a flow state. You are absorbed in the present moment. And when you are there in that moment, and it's just you, your ball, and your target, and you've got a 150-yard shot into the green, and you're totally absorbed in the task of hitting that little white ball from point A to point B in the most efficient, effective, and economical manner, you are now, you know, really taking a really big step towards really being immersed and becoming one, you know, with your target. And that's really what the flow state is all about. People talk about being in the zone, but I always talk about having a zone of personal control. You control your thoughts, you control your attitude, your time, your routine, and you control, you know, what you want to, you know, choose to think. And so, you know, the more that you choose to think like an athlete, you choose to think, you know, hey, I've got this shot, that you choose to be confident. When you step into the golf ball with that type of a mindset, it's amazing, you know, that that golf ball understands what you're really thinking, and it sort of responds as well. Conversely, if you walk into a shot with doubt, dread, and worry, and you just go, well, I'm just going to go ahead and hit and hope, or and just hit the anyway shot goes anywhere. So that's why it's so important from behind the ball, you make a purposeful decision. And that's really what I've been telling all these young golfers that I've been working with all over the globe. And it's just three very basic things, you know, play your game, beat the course, one shot at a time.
Doc, you're working with a young lady here at Georgia State. She plays out on the women's team. Recently had her best finish ever, and it happened to be at the GSU Invitational here at Rivermont Golf Club. Talk about Mahina Laveau.
Mahina Laveau has been, you know, a great senior player playing for Ket Chong's team for the Georgia State Panthers. And she comes from France, and I've known, you know, her now for 2 or 3 years. And she's really just starting to come into her own. She's really just finally saying, hey, this is my, you know, final go around. And she's really putting up some good numbers, and she did a great job there. And she led, you know, Georgia State, you know, to a runner-up finish there in that tournament. So Mahina's doing great. I've got another girl, Sage Parsetich, plays for Indiana Wesleyan University. She just won her first big tournament this past, you know, weekend at Purgatory Golf Club there in Noblesville, Indiana. And we've been talking on the phone, you know, now this past winter. And, you know, it's so funny because the Mahina, the Georgia State team, the Ball State, you know, women's team, and all these other teams, you know, along through the years that I've worked with and talked with, it's funny how all these kids finally adopt, you know, these sort of strategies we've been talking about. And they always, you know, come back to me and they go, you know what? It's the darndest thing. Is that, you know, when I think good things start to happen. You know, it's just really, you know, people always laugh. And I'm always saying, you know, where your mind goes, you know, so does the golf ball. So if you're thinking good thoughts and you have a directed mindset, you know, you're going to be playing some great golf.
So let's take that a step further, because most of us, if we get up on a tee and maybe we've got water down the left or out of bounds down the right, we start to think about where we don't want the golf ball to go. Well, I don't want to hit it left. Well, I sure hope I don't hook this one left. Oh, I hope I don't fade this one into those trees. And invariably, that is where the golf ball ends up going. Talk about blocking those things out and hitting good shots.
Wow. I mean, there was a great, you know, professor by the name of Dr. Daniel Wagner, who came, you know, from North Texas State. And then he was at University of Virginia for a while. Now I think he's at Harvard. But I had a chance to spend some time, you know, with Dr. Wagner. And he had written a book called White Bears and Mind Control. And he was talking about, you know, when we say things like don't hit it right or don't leave it short, what he was really talking about was a theory that he was actually promoting. It was called the ironic process theory. The irony is what you don't want to have happen. It almost, you know, subconsciously, and you're almost suppressing it to cause it to happen. So when someone says, wow, there's out of bounds on the right, and you look up there and you step up on the tee ball, and the last thing you say to yourself is, boy, I don't want to go right. You know, the brain hears that last thing that you say, and it says, hey, Chris says something about going right. Let's make sure that he can go right. And so you sit there and go, God, that's exactly what I didn't want to do. That's the ironic thought process, you know, in action. Here's really what I tell people. You know, when you step into a shot and you have a lot of doubt, and I'm really big on acronyms, all right? Sort of like FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation. That's an acronym. The word doubt, D-O-U-B-T. So I always have players, you know, put a slash between the O and the U. And I'm always saying, you know, we're always saying, don't do this. That's a don't focus. I want them to get into the do. And do, and it's U-B-T, because when we have doubt, when we step into a ball, you know, we ask ourselves this question, do you believe this? Do you believe this ball is going to go to the target? No, I think you've got doubt. I don't think it's going to go there. So I'm always trying to get people into the do and let go of the don't talk. Quit talking about what you want to avoid and put your attention and intention and energy into where you want to go. This is what I want to do. I want to do this, and I'm going to do this right now. And again, if we think about, you know, Nike company, you know, they had three words, just do it. And that's really what we have to do. We have to be able to tell ourselves, this is what I've been planning to do. This is what I'm committing I'm going to do. And this is what I'm going to do right now. And so that commitment to say, this is what I'm going to do, and this is where I want to go, it's really very powerful, Chris. And it's really a lot of basis for my applied sports psychology work with golfers.
Dr. Bob, you hinted to me that you have a great story about a man that you met years ago, a very famous man. It's a story you've kept secret over the years, but you might be willing to tell it tonight.
I will. I will, Chris. Thank you for, you know, allowing me to share this. Many years ago, it was like 1977, I was doing my master's at Ball State University. And I knew I was going to actually, you know, turn professional and try to, you know, to go after my PGA Tour card. So I had, you know, one of my great friends, he was also a fraternity brother, his name was Bob Prang, who was also a member of the Ball State University golf team. He graduated a couple of years before me. He was working out at Bermuda Dunes Golf Club in, you know, Palm Springs. He was working under one Mr. Bill Ogden. And he said, listen, you've got, you know, a big, long, you know, break. Why don't you come out here and spend 3, 4, 5 weeks out here and, you know, introduce you to Mr. Ogden, and we can, you know, do a lot of things together and get you ready for maybe, you know, this summer and your last summer as an amateur and getting you ready, you know, to play professional golf next year. And I thought, okay, that sounds great. Well, Bill Ogden was the head pro at North Shore, you know, Country Club up in Chicago for many, many years. A great player. He played in many Masters, U.S. Opens, British Opens. Great player. And so I was working for him, and he took a shine to me. I don't know why. And maybe it's because I was just so naive and cocky and confident at the same time. And he said to me one day, he goes, and he had me working the range. And he said, Bobby, he goes, this is Bill Ogden talking. He says, I want you to go down to the range and I want you to observe a fellow down there. He's practicing right now. And he said, you go up and introduce yourself to him and, you know, see what, you know, just observe. Just, you don't have to say too much, but just observe what he's doing. So I said, okay. So I went down, you know, to the Bermuda Dunes range, And I stepped up on the tee. And I saw this man dressed in all brown. And he had brown, sort of, you know, wonderful brown leather shoes. And he was really sharp as a tack. But he was an older, you know, gentleman, lean. And he had kind of like a white, sort of a Hogan-esque type cap. And he had, you know, a pair of, you know, sort of like glasses, kind of, you know, wire rimmed. But he looked more like a banker or an accountant versus a golfer. So I stood about 25 feet behind him and kind of sitting up on this ledge. And I was watching him hit drivers. Now, Chris, when I talk about a gentleman hitting drivers, he would step up and he would go through this very, you know, strong ritual. You know, it was a great routine. And he was hitting, you know, shots with this driver. And they were going out about 250, 260 yards straight as a pin. And they were all landing in the shadow of this one sort of like big tree out there. And he was again and again just hitting shots, just like a robot, you know, like an automaton, just every one. Finally, he turns around, looks at me. He goes, "Hey, young fella." He goes, "What are you looking at?" And I said, "Oh, hi." I said, I'm Bobby Winters. I said, "Mr. Ogden wanted me to come down and kind of watch you." And he said, "Well, you want to watch somebody not, you know, doing something very good?" And I kind of chuckled. And he goes, "What are you chuckling about?" And I go, "Oh, I'm chuckling because I've seen you hit the ball just unbelievably well." And he looked at me. He goes, "Well, what do you want to be, you know, watching me for?" And I said, "Well, I said I'm getting ready, you know, to play, you know, professional golf, and Mr. Ogden thought it might be a good idea, you know, for me to introduce myself to you." And then he looked at me and he asked me. He goes, "Well, are you good?" And I said, "Well, yes, you know, I believe I am very good." And he goes, "Well, that's a start." So I said, "I didn't get your name, by the way." And so I, you know, walked up to him, and he was, you know, a little taller, you know, than me, much back, but, you know, 7-8 inches taller than me. And I said, "I'm Bobby Winters." I said, "I'm from Indiana." And he said, "Well, I'm Jack Fleck." And I said, "Oh, hi, well, hi, Mr. Fleck." And I looked and I stepped back. I go, "Jack Fleck, Jack Fleck." He goes, "Yeah, that Jack Fleck." And I go, "Wow, it's an honor." He goes, "Well," he goes, "you know, I've won some tournaments in my day." And I said, "Wow, you're the guy." "Yeah, I beat Hogan." And I said, "Well, that's fantastic." He goes, "Yeah," he goes, "I got, you know, lucky that one day." And he said, you know, I said, "Wow, can I just want you to just hit a few more?" Now, because I knew who it was. Here's the guy who took on Ben Hogan, you know, in what, 1955 at the Olympic Club in San Francisco. Beats Hogan, shoots 69 to Hogan 72. And I mean, no one really thought Jack Fleck, you know, from Davenport, Iowa, was going to be anybody. I didn't happen to know at the time that Bill Ogden knew Jack Fleck very well. And I think on the eve of his final round, Bill Ogden was talking to Jack because Jack, you know, had something kind of a little peculiar, and Bill had given him kind of a tip for the next day. And so he goes in and he goes out and plays a really good round, makes, you know, like about an 8-footer. To tie Hogan. The next day they go into 18-hole playoff. Jack Fleck wins. Now, as the day goes on, you know, I, you know, say goodbye, you know, to Jack Fleck, and I go into the clubhouse. You know, Bill Ogden, Mr. Ogden's there. He goes, "Well, Bobby, you know, what'd you think?" I go, "Well, what'd I think? I didn't know I was going to be, you know, meeting Jack Fleck, that's for sure." And he goes, "Well, what did you find out?" And I looked at him and I said, "I got to tell you, this guy is fantastic. I mean, he just hits it great every time he steps up." I said, "But the damnedest thing is," I said, "he doesn't seem, you know, to like any of his shots. None of them are good enough. I don't think he even said, 'Yeah, that felt good. That looks good.' Everything was just, not this." I said, "It was like all his little grunts. You know, nothing was ever right." And Bill Ogden looked me squarely in the eye and he goes, "Well, Bobby," he goes, "you saw exactly what I wanted you to see." He goes, "I told Jack years ago, if Jack had had a different way of looking at things, instead of being so hard on himself," he goes, "he could have won 7 or 8 major championships."
Wow.
And I thought, you know, right there, you know, was one of my very best lessons that I've ever learned. And now, you know, you've given me the opportunity, Chris, to tell a story that I don't think I've ever told, you know, anyone over these last 40, 50 years of meeting some of the best people in the world, the Palmers, the Nicholases, the Sam Sneeds. But it was so funny that Bill Ogden said, "We saw exactly what I wanted you to see." Because, you know, it's all about your attitude. It's all about your focus. And you got to pull the good from the bad.
Indeed. What a great story. Thank you for sharing that, Doc.
That's good.
Story.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to have a whole bunch more of these stories on, you know, because I just love to be with you, Chris. I think you're doing some great stuff out here. And, you know, and I just love listening to all the other guests, you know, on the show as well. I'm just picking up a lot of great tidbits, and I just love some of the human interest stories. You know, it's just these little stories that people have. You know, that's really what makes our game the greatest game ever invented, because we have a game. It's just not a game. It's a lifestyle, and it's just a philosophy about living your life. And that's really what I love about this game, what I love about being with Chris Mascaro next on the tee.
I appreciate that very much, Doc. Before I let you go, remind our listeners again how they can come see you and get copies of your books and follow you on social media.
Well, they can actually follow me on Dr. Bob Winters, Dr. Robert Winters on Facebook, Instagram. You can go to my website, theconfidencedoctor.com. And you can Google me, go to Amazon, you know, have all my books, have all my products there. But if you actually Google Dr. Bob Winters, and I always say this, Chris, it's, you know, you get to be well known if you just live long enough and hang around a lot. Okay. You know, if you just live long enough, people go, "Wow, you're a legend." I go, "Well, you know, you live long enough, you know, you start to, you know, people start to hang that, you know, moniker on you." So yeah, I don't care who you are. If you just love to, you know, to learn, you want to get better and find out how great you can be, you know, call me, because, you know, like I've always said, the moment you change your mind, you change your game.
There you go. Doc, it's always a privilege to have you as part of the show. I can't thank you enough for coming back again this month and sharing these great stories. I'm already looking forward to when you come back in May. Take care, my friend.
Me too, Chris. Have a good Masters. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too.
Now.
See you, Doc. That is the great Dr. Bob Winters. Again, theconfidencedoctor.com is the website. He's got some fantastic books. And I love Smarter Than Your Doubt. Be smarter than your doubt. I'm better than my doubt. Those things resonate so much with me, and I hope you'll carry that with you. And really, the bottom line is, as he said, focus on the positive stuff and let's enjoy the game, and don't let your fears and your doubts be what you focus on. How many times have we all said it, right? If there's a hazard, if there's water, if there's a sand trap, whatever, I don't want to hit it there. I don't want to hit it this other way. I sure hope I don't hit this one left. And the next thing you know, that's exactly where your ball goes. Let's focus on where we do want the ball to go. Let's focus on the positive things and enjoying this game. And the more positive we are, the better our scores are going to be. That's exactly what Doc talked about tonight. Very much excited about having him as a monthly part of this show. Wonderful man, wonderful philosophies. Looking forward to having him back on the show again in May. All right, my friends, thank you for tuning in to part one of this week's edition of Next on the Tee, featuring my guests, Charlie Meacham and Dr. Bob Winters. Part two will be dropping in the next couple of days. It'll feature my conversations with 2003 PGA champion Sean McKeel and one of the top 10 instructors in our game, Martin Chuck. Folks, I can't thank you enough for tuning in and making Next on the Tee a part of your weekly golf content. Until next time, hit 'em straight, my friends.